You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. So, after the thrills, chills, and red wine spills of the biennial ANZUA conference last month, comes the heady and heartwarming delights of our annual AGM next week, our annual general meeting. How much sheer pleasure can Unitarian institutionalism provide you with all at once? Hands up if you're planning to be part of the AGM after next week's service! Right. Okay. That's really okay. Thank you. And look, that's not, if you didn't put your hand up, don't worry, that's really okay. Not everybody is cut out to be, or wants to be, or indeed should be allowed to be, an institutionalist. Institutionalists are those members of an organization who take a real interest in maintaining and managing the ship of the organization itself, the ship that everyone travels in. Contrary to the picture, research says that institutionalists are always a minority of the church community at large. This is known in other organizations as the Pareto principle or the 80-20 rule. You might have heard of that, where 20% of the organization is responsible for about 80% of the ongoing running and output of it. Of course, no one is just an institutionalist. As you see from this graphic, the institutionalists, though a clear minority, have overlapping identities. Because they're committed, they're also activists, so you regularly see them involved in doing things. And of course, they're also members of the congregation. That's the green area. Now, can anyone tell or guess how the highly centralized position of institutionalists might actually be a problem in this schematic? Well, because you become what you do with your attention, an institutionalist's focus through habit has to be rather internal. And the outer areas of this visual, the congregation's interfacings with family, workplace, your social networks, and the wider community we sit in, might be out of their field of vision for much of the time. So focused are institutionalists on the internal workings of the organization. But it's these outer areas of this visual where growth, relevance, and a consistent supply of vitality will come from. New people, new energies, new ideas, drawing those adrift at the cold margins into the warm harbor of connected fellowship. This bifocal attention, the internal and the external, needs to be balanced. So a few years ago, I called together what's now called the 2020 Committee, a small and diverse group of people, diverse in age, gender, and tenure at the church, who have useful work-life experience outside church circles and a willingness to imagine a larger vision and mission of the church in the community. Their work is to do the blue sky thinking, if you will. Mission and vision. Together with the committee of management, who are focused on the running of the ship and figuring out how new things can be made to work and paid for, they have a great yin-yang dynamic, balancing dreaming and actualizing. And it's been the combination of these two forces, creativity and institutionalism, that has been, I think, the engine of the growing vitality and relevance of this church. Still, despite the fact that we have two groups doing different things, the Pareto principle still seems to apply. There's still only about 20% of the people doing 80% of the output, because even both together, the institutionalists are still few. These 20% are the unsung heroes of any organization. And unsung, you know, they have no song, no theme tune, which is a shame. So here one is. I'm going to call it the anthem of the 20%. And we're running a little shy of time today, so I'll just give you the point of this. This is the old children's song, This Old Man. Here I am all alone, can't do this job on my own, but if you come with me, it scans a bit poorly. If you come with me, then it'll soon be done. Two can do much more than one, and you see it scrolls through. Here we are, just us two, but if you join us, there'll be three, and if you join us, there'll be four, and we can get more done, and we can get five, and then it gets a little up to six. You know, that's a working team right there. That's a basketball team. And then it gets a little Jesus-y, so I'm just, you know, just kind of getting... So Jesus only had 12 people, and, you know, that shook the world. So I was going to encourage you to abandon your academic objectivity and join in on that song. But we're just going to call it the anthem of the 20% for now, which is, you know, one person doing work added to another makes it easier, just like the story about geese today. So we need to recognize that any community requires a certain degree of reciprocity for the social fabric just to survive. I mean, 20%. And according to the Pareto principle, is the minimum. But many organizations get by with a lot less than 20%. And this is not just a church issue, but reflects, as this graphic does, our wider culture. This has been going around social media under the heading, Today's Society, and perfectly nails the difference between individual privilege and collective responsibility. This is how you know neoliberal consumerism has won the public debate and so colonized our thinking. We're encouraged by the culture to take what we can from the social fabric and from the institutions that hold it together and shun responsibility for maintaining them. It's not our problem until bridges collapse, and it is. And I mean, you see this dynamic played out in debates about climate change, welfare, tax cuts, tax avoidance. For the past couple generations, the neoliberal conversation has been all about minimizing our obligations and maximizing our benefits, our personal benefits. But of course, any benefits we accrue personally are contingent, are dependent on those social networks holding together. The interconnected web of being, that famous phrase of Unitarians, takes many forms. Social webs, economic webs, political webs, environmental webs. And if our personal pleasures and benefits depend on and implicate a network of others, it seems to me the very least we can do is acknowledge that by giving something back to those networks and the institutions when we are able. This reading you're about to hear from a Unitarian minister emeritus is a litmus test for where you are with your sense of mutuality with your church. While you're listening to this reading, try to be attentive to your emotional response to it. It's going to say a lot about whether my trying to get you to consider becoming an institutionalist today is hitting a brick wall or not. Richard.
From Tulsa, Oklahoma's minister emeritus, John Wolfe. There is only one reason for joining a Unitarian Universalist church, and that is to support it. You want to support it because it stands against superstition and fear, because this church points to what is noblest and best in human life, because it is open to women and men of whatever race, creed, colour, place of origin, or sexual orientation. You want to support a Unitarian Universalist church because it has a free pulpit, because you can hear ideas expressed there which would cost any other minister his or her job. You want to support it because it is a place where children come without being saddled with guilt or terrified of some celestial peeping Tom, where they can learn that religion is for joy, for gratitude and love. You want to support it because it is a place where walls between people are torn down rather than built up. Because it is a place for religious displaced persons of our time, the refugees from mixed marriages, the unwanted free thinkers, and those who insist against orthodoxy that they must work out their own beliefs. You want to support a Unitarian Universalist church because it is more concerned with human beings than with dogmas, because it searches for the holy rather than dwelling upon the depraved, because it calls no one a sinner, yet knows how deep is the struggle in each person's breast and how great is the hunger for what is good. You want it to support a Unitarian Universalist Church because it can laugh, because it stands for something in a day when religion is still more concerned with platitudes than with prejudice and war. You want to support it not because it buys you some insurance policy towards your funeral service, but because it insults neither your intelligence nor your conscience, and because it calls you to worship what is truly worthy of your sacrifice. There is only one reason for joining a Unitarian Universalist Church: to support it.
Thank you, Richard. Was your first reaction to hearing that something like, oh man, more obligations? I just want to come and feel good. I have a job and a family for all the aggravation I need. Was that something like, you know, was it sort of a little guilt trippy? You know, you have to support it if you join it. Look, I've heard that reading several times in my 25 years as a Unitarian, and that was more or less my first reaction to it. Because the truth is, I am not now, nor have I ever been, an institutionalist at heart. And it's not a judgment on those who are, and it's not from some deeply held beliefs. It's just taste, disposition. I've been in institutional roles in lots of different contexts, faculty boards, university administration, and so on, and I've just always found, you know, meetings with Robert's Rules of Order, agenda, minutes, motions, seconds, votes, debate for its own sake, to be wrist-slittingly dull, unproductive, and even counterproductive to institutional progress, and I would be lying if I told you any different. I would. I'd be lying if I said, oh, be like me. I'm an institutionalist. I'm not. However, that does not mean that other people won't enjoy and actually blossom in those environments. People are different and have different dispositions and abilities. And to function well, organizations of any scale, big or little, need the pragmatic, thoughtful, unassuming folk who are prepared to work hard at unsexy things, often through dull, grinding procedural means, in order to make the organization function better. There are lots of things that get done here that you never see anyone doing. And that's why there are no pictures. Because those unsexy things don't get photographed. But they get done. And you only notice if it stops. This doesn't mean institutions are inherently good things. I've been a part of institutions of many shapes and sizes, and I can tell you this. I've never found one that was worthy of the people that made it up. Institutions are clunky, flawed constructs, and no human institution ever created won't at some point betray whatever faith you put in it. Think of government departments, corporations, large workplaces, and mainline religious institutions. I mean, the problem with such large institutions is precisely to do with scale, with size. The larger the thing is, the less human, the less humane. And the most inefficient, the most dangerous, potentially. The dysfunction that large institutions can foster is often not so much a people problem as an architectural problem, flaws in the very scaffolding required to hold up so large a structure. The way a church is institutionally structured can tell you whether you might want to be involved at an institutional level or not. Let's look at a few examples. Few such structures. This was the structure of church polity before the Reformation. As you can see, this amounted to a feudal caste system. Lots of power concentrated in one figure at the very top, and that top was very separated from and far superior in status to the bottom. The bottom is the faithful. That's us. This is the church political structure after the Reformation, what's known as the episcopal model. There are no more popes. Oh, thank God for that. Now we have an archbishop. And actually more kinds of bishops. And actually more levels of hierarchy and management. There are new levels of middle management added. But no real change in the sense of hierarchical power, class, or distance from ordinary members. Look how far the congregation is from the archbishop. Now, of course, look, some people thrive in large bureaucracies. My wife does, you know. She loves being part of a large institution. They learn to work the system. But it's not, it's worth thinking about whether a church should be that way or not. This is free church congregational policy of the late Reformation, the one we're descended from. As you can see, it's a pretty radical shift in hierarchy and large bureaucracies. It's closer to the people on the ground. Now, look, I know, knowing that matters of faith in supernatural forces is so uncertain that no group of people should presume they speak for God, this is more like what we are now. Does the Spirit or God or the good guide and direct our institution through you, the congregation? Well, we might hope so. We might strive for it to be so, but we'd probably stop short of claiming that as a certainty. At next week's AGM, we are looking for a few new members of the Committee of Management Board, and we're looking for some new blood for the 2020 committee. And the expected thing for a person in my position to do is to encourage you to get involved in institutional work, knowing most of you won't necessarily be inclined. Why might you want to consider being inclined to be an institutionalist? I'm going to give you three reasons. First, because our institutional structure, this late Reformation free church institutional polity, is perhaps the least worst of the ones I've shown you. Think about it. If every church, mosque, and synagogue was independent and self-run rather than part of a huge buck-passing hierarchy at great distance, and the congregation just lived its values, then the people in the pews would never countenance things like protecting child molesters or encouraging suicide bombings. It is the large hierarchical religious institutions that have made such outrageous behavior acceptable for love of the institution itself. An independent church community is the least likely to do the kind of evil a highly institutionalized church can. The small, local, self-governed institution like ours is the most accessible, the most accountable, and the most transparent in form of governance. I don't put my faith in institutions, and I'm not sure I have faith in a God who is imminent and involved in human affairs through any size bureaucracy. Why would he do that? But I do have faith in people. I do have faith in people and in face-to-face, person-to-person relationships. Left to their own devices, most human beings in small groups of up to maybe 100, 120 or so, where they know others and are known by others, will generally do the right thing, the compassionate thing, the charitable thing, the life-affirming thing, or at least they won't prevent it. So is our small-scale, localized, institutional church polity, the one we have here, is it perfect? Of course not. But if it's not, only folks like you can make it better. So that's the second reason to consider getting involved, is that the history of anything is made by those who bother to show up. And my friends, I'm about to tell you two hair-raising examples of even how our localized, locally run, small-scale, congregational polity Unitarian churches can go horribly wrong simply by virtue of who shows up and takes a particular interest. In 2001-2002, an Australian Unitarian church that shall remain nameless for legal reasons, but with significant land assets, was pretty ruthlessly branch-stacked and usurped by fringe radical political groups such as Workers Against Imperialism, the Australia-Cuba Friendship Society, and militant trade unions. They showed up and they took an interest, and now it's no longer recognizably a church of any kind. It's more like weekly meetings of the Fabian Society. And those local Unitarians who are seeking genuine worshipful spiritual community have had to make their own elsewhere without the church's assets. Example number two of how things even at the local small level can go horribly wrong. In the UK, another Unitarian church that shall remain nameless for legal reasons. You getting this, Azio? Was essentially taken over by one powerful extended family And for many years, they simply used it on Sundays for the family members to give musical recitals for other family members, as if it were their lounge room. Any newcomer was quickly made to feel they weren't meant to be there. Public worship became a private affair. And you might say, oh, well, that could never happen here, but I'll bet the rent that is exactly what they said. These are true stories that illustrate that the fate of small local institutions like our church is decided by who takes an interest. Our tolerance and our reputation for tolerance can make us a soft target for the ruthless. But if you value something, you nurture it, you guide it, you protect it, which is the final reason you might want to consider getting involved: to grow in love. Is it possible for or too much today to talk about loving a church? I mean not in the sense of feeling all romantic about it and bringing it flowers and rhapsodizing under its balcony. You can't love an institution, which is after all only an architectural sketch of procedures and power relationships, but you can love people. Think of the way you love your children. You don't always like them. Or am I the only one? But you always want what's best for them. You don't always like them, but you always want what's best for them. This is what Immanuel Kant, the famous philosopher, called practical love. It's a love based in the will and choice rather than in changeable, ungovernable feelings, which he called the opposite, pathological love, pathos, feelings. He said only practical love has true moral worth, because you can't help how you feel, and so you can't take credit for it. Here's the thing, though. If you practice love, if you do practical love for something, chances are you'll develop feelings of love for it. When you routinely ask yourself, what do I need to do? What can I do to influence for the better, those I'm supposed to serve and associate with? And you choose to do that consistently for years, guess what happens? You change. You end up loving it. And when I say, as minister, I love you, for I do, that doesn't mean I have warm, fuzzy feelings for all of you, for I don't, and I shouldn't. Think about it. But to say I love my church simply means I will good toward it. I will good toward it, and the depth of feeling that creates over time. Well, you would certainly feel bereft if you were me when cherished faces vanish forever, as a couple recently have. You feel bereft. Which is why, and I should apologize to those of you that were at Kevin Fisher's funeral. I mean, I did his funeral and I held it together, but at the end I blubbed like a baby, precisely because I felt personally bereft. Very unprofessional. You will be surprised by the depth of affection that can develop through practicing love toward an institution of not too many people who are neither kith nor kin. They're not your relations and they're not your intimates. Your love can grow. I've seen it. In fact, I've lived it. Why become an institutionalist in so small an institution? Why get to grips with the Constitution and governance and decision making? What difference can a few committed people make? Well, that started small, with 12. And 2,000 years later, it's still being talked about. But the last thing Jesus was an institutionalist. There was no constitution for the apostles. His band of brothers and sisters was small, mobile, nimble, and flat in hierarchical structure. The early churches that followed this ministry was a loose association of small, local, self-governed groups in far-flung places like Corinth, Ephesus, Thessaly, Philippi, and this one in Damascus. This is a first century church. This would be about the time of Paul. It's about the size of Shady Grove. Not many people. It's on a scale like ours, really. The massive institution of the Roman Church that grew out of these and perpetuated arguably as much evil as good, maybe more, was not the original aim or mission. It was the passionate commitment of a few, a happy few, a band of brothers and sisters that shook the wide world for millennia. How do we know we can make a difference? You and me. Because history is on our side. As Margaret Mead famously said, it is not brilliant individuals, and it's not bureaucratic institutions, but small, committed groups that are the only thing that has ever, ever made a difference. So may it be. Amen.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.